Good morning once again, dear friends, dear Thai, dear Sangha. I'm very glad you're here, that you've made the time to come here at this time of year when it's particularly busy, full of scheduling, and also just make the time to come here to engage in this practice of true transformation. The Buddha discovered this path. I was thinking 2,600 years ago, but we've been saying that for a while, so it's probably getting close to 2,700 years ago. And realize that there's a way that we can find relief and ease and ending of suffering in the very midst of the world. We don't have to go anywhere else. We don't have to do anything else. We simply need to find a way to be at ease, find peace inside when the outside is not at all peaceful. We're particularly challenged these days to do that. We might have our own family members with whom we're not at peace, friends, co-workers, and then of course the wars that are raging on across our earth, those that are well known and those that aren't. I'm always heartened that our teacher, the Venerable Thich Nhat Hanh, that founded this Plum Village tradition, founded it at a time of war, during the war in Vietnam. He was very active in finding peace not just for the people that he lived with, but also inside. The challenge with speaking for peace is that often people think that you're supporting the other side. Whatever side that is. Because peace is non-ideological. It's non-partisan. Peace is simply peace. And I think as practitioners, finding ways of cultivating that peace in our everyday life can be a model, can be a gift that we offer to the rest of the world. So I want to share something that's definitely a first world problem that I encountered, that doesn't have all the trappings of that introduction. But about a month and a half ago, I was driving our oldest son to a chess tournament, and somebody hit her car. It was really minor. We were going slow, but as you know, cars are easily damaged, and there was a lot of concern on my part that the car wasn't going to get repaired. And I remember one night I woke up in the middle of the night, very anxious about, like, is it going to get repaired or not? If it's not, what am I going to do? And I say it's a first world problem because it was more just kind of inconvenience and stress for our family rather than kind of our livelihood. But it still activated all that seed of worry and anxiety. And so that morning, I brought that anxiety to the meditation cushion. And it just hit me so clearly how bad I am and how bad many people are at uncertainty about not knowing what the future holds. And one thought that I had was like, man, if I'm this worked up over a car, what if it was like one of my kids that was sick? Not comparing suffering, not saying that it has to be dramatic in order for it to have an effect. But it just made me realize that, oh, I need to do a little work practicing with uncertainty in general. Because there will be situations that are much, much more difficult than just a car. And so one of the things that we've been doing here on this retreat so far is really focusing in on what is happening right now. What is happening in our present moment, circumstance? And so breathing in, aware of what is happening inside and around me. Breathing out, observing what is inside and around me. My worry about the car, that was a worry about something that hadn't happened yet. Because when I looked at where I was just sitting on the cushion at home. It was very peaceful, very at ease. The present moment is a wonderful antidote to that kind of uncertainty. Because uncertainty is just not knowing what's going to happen in the future. That's all it is. But we can know what's happening right now. We can know what's happening all around us. And that antidote, the present moment, can bring us a lot of peace. Of course, there are times when the present moment is not filled with peace, when there's something very difficult happening. So that's one of the reasons that it's very important to practice cultivating and generating that peace inside when things are going well. We don't want to have just always a response to emergency. We want to be able to enjoy what's happening inside and around us so that we can bring that forward in times when we really need it. It's a very powerful practice, the present moment. It's a very powerful way of training ourselves, training our minds to really notice, to really generate that feeling of ease. Because then when we have that stability of being here, being right now, in the present, we can ask, well, can I do something? Is there something that I can do to take care of whatever it is that's bothering me? And if the answer is yes, then we can go do it. And if the answer is no, then we can just enjoy being in the present moment. I heard recently that worry, anxiety, is just solving a problem that hasn't happened yet. And we spend all of that time trying to solve those problems that haven't even happened yet. I heard another quote, I can't remember who it's attributed to, but worry is the worst use of our imagination. Because really, that's what we're doing, we're imagining And then we're creating all these things that could go wrong. Nothing wrong with preparing. Nothing wrong with getting ready. But it's that coming back to what's happening now and then asking, is there something that I can actually do about this? And then going forward from there. It's a way of finding the peace that is already here. It's a way of noticing the peace, the stability, the balance that's already here. I'm always cautious about that because sometimes it can be easy just to say, like, well, I'm just going to stay here in this peace. I'm not going to go out into the world. That's why that question of, can I do something, is important. Because even though worry might be a poor use of our imagination, it's also indicating to us that there's something amiss, something that's not right. And so instead of spending our time thinking about it, we can spend our time either taking care of it or not, if it's not something we can take care of immediately. But it guides us, and it guides us from that place of peace, of stability, of balance. And so we're really finding that balance by resting in the present moment. One of the mindfulness trainings of the Order of Interbeing, that is the order that Thich Nhat Hanh founded, is to be aware of the present moment, and that in the present moment there's more than enough seeds of happiness. And I always remember that he wrote that during wartime. He wrote that when he saw immense suffering. And that insight that he had didn't once stop him from going into places of suffering, from going into either inside places of suffering or outside places of suffering. And he chose to engage. And he still said that there's more than enough conditions for happiness. I think that's a very powerful statement and insight that can give us some faith, give us some encouragement along our own path. Because most of us are not in the midst of a war zone right now. And that invitation to look at and look around for the causes, for the conditions of happiness, is part of our practice of being in the present moment. Part of our practice of finding that stability when we most need it. And so we come on a retreat or come on a day of mindfulness so that we can touch into that place. We create a lot of conditions for happiness on these retreats. There's a lot of work that goes into making it feel very smooth. And we come to a beautiful location to water those seeds, to find that place inside of us, to remember that it's there. We drop our schedules. My children wanted to come on the retreat with us, and Unfortunately, my wife wasn't able to come tomorrow, so we had to tell the kids that they couldn't come. And they were really disappointed. And they asked why, and I said, well, I said, y'all kind of argue with me quite a bit. And I don't know that I would be able to lead a retreat and kind of manage that. And my youngest child was a little upset and didn't understand, but my teenager said, yeah, that's fair. So we do things so that we can bring in that feeling of peace, including leaving our kids at home. But did I really leave them at home? No, they're here inside. Yeah. But we become so accustomed to ways of being. The Buddha called it habit energies. Another translation is latent tendencies. Things that are inside of us that are very deep. Maybe they're ours that we developed. Maybe they're from our ancestors. Maybe from our familial ancestors, but they might also be from our cultural ancestors. We have these things that come up so quickly, so easily. So we come to a place like this so that we can do two things. One is what I've been talking about, that watering that seed of peace and happiness, really tending to it, letting it come inside of us. But we also come so that some of those habit energies can show themselves a little more clearly, but we can have the space to hold them and have the space to not necessarily react to them. It's much harder when your habit energies are being poked by friends, family, coworkers. It's much actually, if we spent enough time together, if this retreat were like 2-3 months, we would start poking each other's habit energies as well. They may already be activated. It's not a bad thing that we have these habit energies, but it does make it so that it's harder to touch into that balance and peace and stability. So we bring in our practice of cultivating this peace, this ease. Then we also bring in a little bit of our suffering. We don't want to go too much into one or the other. We don't want to always be chasing after this experience of peace, because what will happen is we will isolate ourselves from everyone and just seek out things that are pleasurable and beautiful. And we don't want to spend all our time being in suffering, either our own or other people's, because then we'll start to only know suffering. And we'll forget that peace and joy are available. It's very important that we do both. I don't know about you all, but I feel like I'm wired and trained to look at suffering a lot more than I am to look at peace and joy. Partly familial, partly culturally, partly maybe just disposition. And so one of the benefits of retreat is that even though some of those habit energies can come up, we have much more conditions for peace and ease and well-being that we can really just take the time to allow ourselves to experience. Because how much time do we spend allowing ourselves to suffer? quite a bit, I would think. Because they're both real. They're both here. Suffering and joy and peace, they're all here. And we want to take good care of all of it so that it can truly transform. I was looking back at those 14 mindfulness trainings. I referenced the one, but there's another mindfulness training, again, written and transmitted during wartime, that was awareness of suffering. Not to turn away from suffering. When I was looking at it again, one of the lines really jumped out at me. And at the end, it says, we want to find ways to be in contact with suffering. And then there's a little list, personal contact, or electronic means, telephone, those kinds of things. But that's not the line that jumped out. It was what was said after that. And it was so that we can help them transform into peace and joy and freedom and compassion. I think it's very important to remember that when we contact suffering, we do so so that we can help it to transform. Sometimes the information that comes in, either through conversations or through media, through that, is just being aware of suffering. But often, I feel so helpless afterwards. I can't help it to transform. Sometimes that awareness of suffering can be transformed inside and lead into that, what am I going to do, the action part. But more often it waters the seeds both of suffering and of helplessness inside. So I want to be very careful that when I'm contacting suffering, I'm doing so that I can help it to transform. And to know when that capacity has been reached inside, so that we're not carried away by the suffering. These are very deep, fundamental practices to our tradition. All of these arms of practice, of cultivating joy and peace, of awareness of suffering. And I think it's important to give ourselves that permission to not connect to suffering, to not contact to suffering, if we're not in a position in that moment to help it to transform. Sometimes when we contact that suffering, it can give us the impetus we need to go work with others, to work towards transformation. But just to be aware of why we are contacting that suffering. For the longest time, I missed that line, and I thought that I was supposed to connect to suffering. Be aware of suffering. I mean, it's right there. This mindfulness training is called awareness of suffering. And so I felt that sometimes if I came on retreat or did these kinds of things that watered that seed of peace and joy inside of me, that I wasn't really honoring that mindfulness training. But what I've learned is that I was watering the capacity to be able to not only hold the suffering, but to be aware of when it when I need it and how I can go about transforming it. There's a lovely program on the Plum Village app, and I think it's also on the Deer Park Monastery page by Brother Phat Lu, who's an amazing scholar and linguist. And he offers a course on the 40 tenets of Plum Village tradition. These were offered on a retreat by Thich Nhat Hanh to distinguish each school of Buddhism has a particular set of tenets or beliefs that they ascribe to, born of the insight of the founder. And so these 40 tenets just speak a little bit to how the Plum Village tradition is slightly different from other Zen practices. Other traditions. And the 15th tenet talks about awareness of suffering, and it fits right into that mindfulness training. And it says that awareness of suffering helps us recognize the existing conditions of happiness and also helps prevent the condition of wrong actions and the planting of negative seeds that will bring about suffering. So this awareness of suffering, not only opens our hearts up, and makes us feel compassionate and loving, tender, brokenhearted, maybe afraid. But awareness of suffering is done in a way that also makes us aware of the conditions of happiness. It's a very deep insight into how suffering and happiness are interconnected, but also how avoiding suffering, avoiding that experience of suffering, helps us also avoid happiness. And in fact, sometimes when we're acutely aware of suffering, it can make the other elements of happiness even more profound. I remember years ago, in the early 2000s, I worked at Camp Make a Dream, which is a camp that's an oncology camp for children. And they also have adult programs there. And there was a young adult who had a diagnosis of an inoperable brain tumor. And she wrote about this really lovely poster she made of just text, black text, that said, "Before cancer," and it talked about get up, take a shower, eat breakfast, go to work, just all those things. And then she wrote, "After cancer," and then brought about all, used all the colors that were available. And it said, "Get up and just appreciate that I have another day to be here." And then take a shower with, feel gratitude for the warm water cleansing my body, and that I can experience this, all of these things. And so she went through each action of the day and transformed it into an experience of joy, of peace, really of being very, very present. And I think that's a perfect example of how awareness of suffering can highlight the conditions for happiness. We don't need to we don't need to be sick to do that. We can do that today. We can do that right now. Maybe just take a moment to think about what are the conditions for happiness for you right here, right now. Maybe you're a little uncomfortable from sitting, so you can use that as your suffering. And just, you don't have to say it out loud, but just take note of it. It's very beautiful. And we use this opportunity, as I said, now, today, here, when we've created so many conditions to find ease and peace and joy and balance, happiness. So that when we're in situations that don't immediately appear to have conditions for happiness, that we can touch them. This is the time where I remind you that this is a practice for you and not a practice to try to push on other people. So if someone's in a place of difficulty, it's not terribly helpful to say to them, but all these conditions for happiness are right there. Why can't you find them? These practices are for you to take, to work with, to experience. But I do guarantee you that if you practice this with somebody who is suffering, maybe not that day, but eventually they will also start to see them with you. You don't have to say anything. So we practice this capacity to hold others' suffering, just like we hold our own suffering, and to find the conditions for happiness. It's not an or. It's not an or. Being with somebody's suffering or being with our own suffering doesn't come at the expense of touching into peace or happiness. Just like touching into peace and happiness doesn't come at the expense of the suffering that's there. We can practice both at the same time. And in this way, we are very engaged. We're very present to the people around us, to ourselves. Because we are including everything, everything at once. We got a little taste of this last night during the guided relaxation, but also during our sitting meditations today, where we practice being aware of our whole experience at once. And it's a very interesting kind of concentration. Usually we think of concentration as kind of grabbing onto something and holding it. But this is a kind of concentration that's really wide open. The kind of concentration, it's actually quite fragile. You might notice like a loud sound or something collapses it, and we zero in on that sound. And then we have to gently open it back up again so that we can include it. Well, Thich Nhat Hanh has translated the word upeksha as inclusivity. Often upeksha is translated as equanimity, but he chose to translate it as inclusivity for this reason. And as a Dharma friend reminded me, one of the reasons is that he translated what you do, what the practice is, rather than what you look like or what you experience. So equanimity might be how we feel about it, how we experience it, but inclusivity is how we get there, by including. So it's the same idea, it's just looking at the means rather than the ends. In the Discourse on Happiness, there's a series of verses that talk about this is the greatest happiness. And towards the end of that sutra, they talk about to live in the world with your heart undisturbed by the world, with all sorrows ended, dwelling in peace. This is the greatest happiness. When we hear that, living in the world with our heart undisturbed by the world, that's a tall order. There's some pretty disturbing things in the world. Think what the invitation here is. It's not to be unaffected by the world, to really let it affect us, to let it touch us, to include it, to include all of that. But not to lose our sense of stability, our sense of ease. To not be carried away by the suffering. To still be able to find the conditions for happiness, even in the midst of some of the most horrible things that we have seen or read or heard or experienced. Gives that invitation that this is the greatest happiness, a little more impact. It's the greatest happiness because it's the kind of happiness that comes about that includes all of the suffering. Boy, as I say that, another experience from camp, Make a Dream, comes to mind. Yeah. There was a young person who wrote, the sweetest smile is the one that comes through our tears. And what a powerful statement. It's the sweetest smile because it doesn't leave out the sadness. But it's still there. The smile is still there. Somebody asked about Sangha practice. What is a Sangha? So we are a Sangha because we're all here, we're all practicing together. Historically, a Sangha was a community of practitioners. One of the three jewels of Buddhism, the other two being the Buddha and the Dharma, the Buddha, the historical person, but also that capacity in ourselves to be awake, and the Dharma, which is the teachings. And then the Sangha, the community that works together, that does these things together. And I bring it up at this point because there are days, maybe weeks, months, when I just don't have the capacity to do any of this stuff that I've been talking about. There are days when my heart is just too broken and too full. And maybe there's moments too when I'm caught by habit energies, historical habit energies that are just carrying me. And then I remember that it's not just me that's doing this. It's you too. And so one of the things that a Sangha is, it's a little extension of our mind, of our heart. Our mind feels very personal, like it's just ours. That's a little bit of an illusion. In our one of our guided meditations today, we looked at the mind and that it comes from our life experience, our generations of ancestors, our culture. But even right now, you know, our mind isn't necessarily just ours. It's being influenced by, you know, the person sitting next to you. It's breathing. It's present. It's being influenced by, you know, this beautiful place, by the quiet. And those seeds of peace are being watered. Those seeds of happiness are being watered. And so on those days when it's too much for me or for you to do it by yourself, you can come, if you can physically show up, you can be there with the Sangha. And they can breathe with you and let those experiences transform, be held. If you're not in a place where you can physically go be with the Sangha, either for proximal spatial reasons or health reasons, you can remember that there's a group of people that are practicing right now to cultivate this awareness of suffering so that the conditions of happiness are more apparent. You can even ask them to do it for you. You can say, my Sangha, the Sangha that I'm carrying in my heart, I know you're out there somewhere. Will you breathe for me, please? Someone out there is doing that right now for you, with you. And the joy is when you're in a place where you're not overwhelmed, where your suffering is held and the joy is held. You're doing it for somebody else. There's someone else out there that's struggling, and you are breathing. You are finding peace. You're finding that ease, that balance, is supporting them because they know you're out there doing it right now. And how much more lovely it is when we can do it in person, like today, to be here. So we come into this place, this time, bringing our whole selves, bringing all of our grief and worry, all of our capacity for joy, for happiness. And we bring it and we offer it to the Sangha, to this group that's here today. And also, as Gina mentioned earlier, the Sangha of the lake and the trees, of this very earth that we stand on. We bring it and we offer it. And together we offer this transformation. So many people say, you know, I have a meditation practice that I've been doing on my own, but it's so different when I'm meditating with other people. I have that experience too. Part of the reason it's different is that we're supporting one another. Maybe at home we kind of open one eye and look at the timer and be like, yeah, close enough. But then when we come into Sangha, we might open an eye and look at the clock, but then we're like, oh, everyone else is still breathing. I'm going to let their practice support me a little bit. It's a really powerful and beautiful practice, but you can also see how we have to be careful the communities that we're with and what seeds are being watered and how we're watering them. We don't have to avoid them. We just have to be careful. We just have to notice when our mind is becoming clouded, or when our mind is becoming heavily influenced by whatever community we're choosing to engage with, whether it's online or in person. We want to just become aware so that we can come back into this kind of community where we can really find our aspiration. So as we're reminded that our minds really are shared. They're not as individual as we like to think they are. I still hear my parents, but it's in my own voice now. And I know that because I see my children and I see my voice as their own, for better and worse. And as our minds are not solely our own, It's important to take care of the parts that we can take care of. Because truly, when we do this kind of transformative work inside, it affects the whole world. It really does. Each time we encounter some difficulty or suffering and we don't react, and we respond, we still act, but it's not out of reactivity. When we come from that place of stability, we help transform the world a little bit. Just like when we release an old habit energy that came from us from who knows how long ago, thousands of years ago. When we release that habit energy, we heal all of our ancestors. And then we stop that seed in all of our descendants. Whether it's our family descendants or our descendants simply from the people that we encounter. It's very powerful work. But it can only be done when we remember that we're not alone. That this practice of transformation is a truly collective effort, which is why we come together, so that we can do it together. So that we can learn from one another and see other possibilities inside of ourselves. And so one of our practices that we can cultivate is this practice of uncertainty. I began today with a little bit of a recollection of my experience with uncertainty. I'm sure you have your own experience with uncertainty. Probably, possibly, more potentially impactful than whether your car gets fixed or not. Maybe not. Maybe that's what's troubling you. And becoming familiar with that experience of uncertainty, and when that arises in us, we kind of have a choice. We can go down the road of trying to solve a problem that hasn't happened yet, or we can use that as a bell of mindfulness to come back to the present, to come back to what is happening right now, right here. And then, once we establish ourselves back in the present, we can say, is there something that I can do? Not meaning that we're going to fix everything with that question, but we can do the next thing. But we can do it from a place of being present. I'll leave you with an insight into this that I learned from my canine Dharma teacher, my dog. We got him as a rescue in February. And he came to us with two big gashes on his neck. He was very lucky to be alive. The kids call him a menace, because he's a very friendly menace, but he gets into lots of things. When I get his harness ready for a walk, he starts barking and sometimes spinning in circles and gets really excited. And then I harness him up and I go out the door. And I was with him the other day, and I realized he has no expectation. He just knows he's going out. He doesn't know if he's going to go out for 2 blocks or if he's going to be out for 4 hours. He just goes. He's just like, all right, this is what I'm doing. He doesn't complain. He's just like, we're going. And I was really touched by that, because I think unintentionally we had a little bit experience of that with our second sit. Did you notice it was a little shorter than the first sit? And did you also notice that little seed come up of like, that was really short. What's going on here? And it made me, like, I was actually chuckling inside because I knew I was going to share this about the dog. And like, the dog wouldn't have cared. And he's just like, oh, I got to sit. That was great. And I love that. I actually love that the sit was that short, because every sit could be that short. Or it could be really long. We don't know. In fact, Sister Chanduk, Sister Annabel Laity, who's the head abbot at Plum Village now, talked about when she was training in India for her practice, the meditations were not any specific time. They were always different. Sometimes they were an hour. Sometimes they were 2 minutes. And how different that is when you sit down, not knowing that it's like, yeah, it'll take me a minute to settle in here, right? And then, or if you wander, it's like, okay, I can bring myself back later. You know, you can always do it later. But what a wonderful practice to sit and not know how long it's going to be. And just be present for that whole time, whether it's 15 seconds or 15 minutes. And so I think about that with the dog, with ourselves, that really trying to be present with what is actually happening, not with what we want to happen or what we expect to happen, but just with what is happening right now, right here. Bringing it all in, wherever we are, and doing it together, whether we're physically together or now that we've all been together, we all carry each other with us. And this group of people, this arrangement of people is unique. Even if the same group of people gathers back here later this afternoon, it will be different. And so we have all just watered each other's seeds of connection, and we can all bring one another with us now, wherever we go. We have a Sangha with us, always. Mm-hmm. Just by being here today, even if this is your first time. So as we move through the rest of our day, we'll really lean on and rely on the practice of the Sangha to support us. When I'm distracted and kind of hurrying to the next thing, and then I see you walking beautifully and mindfully, I can use that. Oh yeah, how nice. Right here, right now. And we can really take stock of and let that seed of ease and peace really take hold in us today. Because we don't always have these kinds of conditions around us. And so we want to carry this retreat with us too, this possibility, into whatever we do next.